The following program is a Zygon International audio presentation.
Often in actual life, and not infrequently in myths and popular tales, we encounter the dull case of the call unanswered, for it is always possible to turn the ear to other interests. Refusal of the summons converts the adventure into its negative. Walled in boredom, hard work, or culture, the subject loses the power of significant affirmative action and becomes a victim to be saved. His flowering world becomes a wasteland of dry stones, and his life feels meaningless. Even though, like King Minos, he may through titanic effort succeed in building an empire of renown. Whatever house he builds, it will be a house of death, a labyrinth of cyclopean walls to hide from him his minotaur. All he can do is create new problems for himself and await the gradual approach of his disintegration. These are the words of Joseph Campbell from his classic work, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. In this age of the religion of materialism, the politics of expediency, and the glorification of greed, there continues to be the still, small voice of the call, the silent, unsung plea within each of us, to give up one's conditioned view of the world and follow the visionary adventure of the creative hero. This is the true challenge of contemporary times. Our guest is Joseph Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Sarah Lawrence College and the world's leading popularizer of mythology. Professor Campbell is the author of the four-volume The Masks of God, also The Mythic Image, Myths to Live By, and The Way of the Animal Powers, Volume 1 of the projected four-volume work, The Historical Atlas of World Mythology. He has also edited The Portable Jung and The Portable Arabian Nights, plus the multi-volume Papers from the Uranos Notebooks. Join us for the next hour as we heed the call and explore the visionary world of myth with Joseph Campbell. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Joseph, welcome.
Michael, it's a delight to be with you again. I was hoping something like this would happen when I got on the plane yesterday in Honolulu.
When did the call first appear in mythology?
In mythology? As the essence of mythology, I would say. The theme of the visionary quest, the one who goes to follow a vision, it appears in practically every mythology I know, one way or another.
So it's like the core genesis of all myth.
Yes, because it is the one who has gone on the adventure and brought back the message who is the founder of institutions and the giver of life and vitality to his community.
You know, later in that chapter in The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which was entitled Refusal of the Call, you talked about how we often follow society, and with the call, the reverse really is what's appropriate.
There are two ways of living a mythologically grounded life, and one is just to what I call the way of the village compound, where you remain within the sphere of your people. That can be a very strong and powerful and noble life. There are, however, people who feel this isn't the whole story. And today, you see, when all historical circumstances are changing, and we no longer have enclosing horizons that shut us away from the knowledge even of other people, when new worlds are breaking in on us all the time, it's inevitable that a person with any sense of openness to new experience will feel, no, this won't do the way we're living. Do you see what I mean? And so one goes out for oneself to find a broader base, a broader relationship. On the other hand, there's plenty of reason for those who don't have this feeling to remain within the field, because our societies are today so rich, you know, in the gifts that they can render. However, if a person has had the sense of what I, in that chapter, called the call, you know, the feeling of there's an adventure for me, and if he doesn't follow that, but that man remains in the society or the in-group only for practical reasons, because this is safe, this is secure, life dries up. And then he comes to that condition which I heard about a few years ago, a definition of late middle age, when you've got to the top of the ladder and found it's against the wrong wall. Now, I taught school in a boys' prep school for 1 year. That was a rough time, I tell you. It's all matters of discipline. But I think that's a critical time in a young man's life. That's when new ideas begin to open up, new possibilities of life. And then Dad is saying, you know, well, I wish you'd study law, which is secure, you know, and none of this fooling around. And I had young men who'd ask me, you know, do you think I can write? Do you think I can write? I could be a writer. I say, do you think you could stand 10 years of not making it? If one has the guts, you might say, to follow the risk, life opens up all along the line. I'm not superstitious, but I do believe in spiritual magic, you might say. I feel if one follows what I call his bliss, the thing that really gets you deep in the gut and that you feel is your life, doors will open up. They do. And they have in my life, and they have in many lives that I know. There will be no program out ahead of you because nobody's ever done this before. But you'd be surprised. If you're on your way, it'll open up. And the other point is, if you follow your bliss, you'll have your bliss, whether you have money or not. If you follow money, you may lose the money and then you don't even have that. The secure way is really the insecure way. Of and the way in which the richness of the quest builds up. Now here I am well along in life and it's still building up, Michael. I tell you, it's terrific.
Sounds great. I'm looking forward to getting older. I listen to you, Joseph, and you make it so positive.
Well, that old story of Browning's, wasn't it? Rabbi Ben Ezra, grow old along with me, the best is yet to be.
You're mentioning the idea of the real security is in having no security. Calls to mind that we live in a society, as I mentioned in the introduction, the religion of materialism, that really stresses the importance of so-called materialistic security. And I'm wondering, and when one looks at other cultures and other mythologies, whether this idea of security has always been present, or is this a phenomena based on 20th century industrial technology progress?
Well, I think the emphasis in our world is there because we have so much of it. The life is made pretty secure for us, so much so that we forget what the dangers of life really are. We even have insurance, even have life insurance. All of this.
Paradoxical.
There's no risk. It's inevitable that would become a heavy, you know. But on the other hand, there are so many examples of people today who have adventured the adventure. Wonderful people. And they are, you might say, counter statements to this emphasis that of the popular mind on security, tenure in the professions, you know, and all that kind of thing.
And in a sense, that it's the going for the jumping over the edge and moving into the adventure that really catalyzes the creativity, isn't it?
I would say so. You don't have creativity otherwise.
Otherwise, there's no fire. You're just following somebody else's rules.
Well, my wife is a dancer, you know, and she has had dance companies for many, many years. And I don't know whether I should talk about this, but when the young people are really adventuring it, it's amazing how much, what gut they have and what meager lives they can be living, you know, and yet the richness of the action in the studio. Then you're going to have a concert season. They all have to join a union. And as soon as they join the union, their character changes. There are certain rules of how many hours a day you can rehearse. There are certain rules of how many weeks of rehearsing. They bring this down like a sledgehammer on the whole thing. And then there are two mentalities. There's the mentality of security, of money, and there's the mentality of the open risk, you know?
In other societies, we can look and see that there are other societies, cultures, that honor elders. In our society, it seems like much the elders are part of the mainstream, and there's a continual kind of wanting to turn away from what the elders have to say, the way it is, the way to do it. And the union example is a typical one where the authority institution, namely the union, comes in and says, this is the way it's done. And then one has to fall into line or one has to find something else to do.
That's right.
And it's like created this dichotomy between the elders and the sons and daughters of the elders. And how do you see that in relationship to other cultures?
Well, this business of the, what this comes to is the conflict of the art, creative art, and economic security. And I don't think I've seen it in other cultures. The artist doesn't have to buck against quite the odds that he has to buck against today.
The artist is honored in other cultures.
He is honored.
Yes.
And quickly honored. Here,
it's a struggle. Non-profit organizations,
yeah.
and the whole route of the struggle.
Or you might just hit it off something that really strikes the need and requirements of the day, and then you've given your gift early, you know. But basically, it's a real risk. And I think that's so in any adventure, even in business. The man who has the idea of a new kind of gift to society, you know, that, and he's willing to risk it. And then the workers come in and claim that they're the ones that did it, you know, and he can't afford even to perform his performance. It's a grotesque conflict, I think, between the security and the creativity ideas. The entrepreneur is a creator. He's running a risk.
Maybe in American capitalistic society, the entrepreneur is the creative hero in some sense.
Oh, I think he is. I mean, the real one. Most people go into economic activities not for risk but for security. Do
yes.
you see what I mean? And
sure.
the other psychology tends to take over.
In that same chapter on The Call and The Hero with a Thousand Faces, you wrote, "The myths and folktales of the whole world make clear that the refusal of the call, is essentially a refusal to give up what one takes to be one's own interest." And then you go on to say about how we get fixed in our own security and mm-hmm. our own ideals and are reluctant to see them change.
Yeah, and it can even get so that you can't make them change.
And it brings up the whole connection of myth to the adventure
yes.
that we've been talking about.
Yes.
I'd like to hear you talk about that.
Well, the myths, there is a kind of regular morphology and inevitable sequence of experiences if you start out to follow your adventure. I don't care whether it's in economics, in art, or just in play. The sense of potentialities and these opening out before you. And you have no idea how to achieve them. you start out into the dark, and then strange little helpmates come along, represented frequently by little fairy spirits or little gnomes or something like this, that gives you just a clue, and this opens out. And then the sense of dangers you always run into, really deep perils, because no one has gone this way before, and the winds blow, and you're in a forest of darkness and terror very often, and then hanging on through that and all. It's something. When I wrote that was 40 years ago. I was writing out of what I had read, you know, and now I've lived it. And I know it's correct. In fact, I was greatly moved by my own writing when you were reading that. I thought, gee, did I write that? Mm. That's how it turned out. I mean, it's valid. These mythic clues work.
Part of that, too, and this is interesting because this is a quote that one normally doesn't hear at the podium on Sundays in the average Christian church, and that is, dread the passage of Jesus, for he does not return. What does that passage mean to you in the context of what we've been talking about?
Jesus represents the inspiration to life. I mean, the life of the spirit, the life not simply of physical conditions, but the thing that is life for man, namely a spiritual adventure. And he comes and is the awakener, is the awakener. And if you close your mind to that awakener, you may not come back again. You can lose it. I think there are many myths, many epic stories of the awakening, which then has passed, and you can't even think what it was. You know, you can't think what it was. There's an extremely interesting psychological story of a woman in the hills of West Virginia, a mining area, who, when she was a little girl, walking through the woods, heard a wonderful music. And when she got home, she forgot what it was. Now, this is a woman in her late 60s who felt that she had missed her life. And it was only while in psychoanalysis that it came out that that song that she had heard was the call. Now, this, curiously, is precisely the problem of the shaman, the young person who is alone on the seashore or in the forest and hears a music. Now, those people have the knowledge that that music must somehow be followed. You must stay with it. And it may make a lonely life for you, but that is your life. And this, to me, was a very interesting thing. I'm sure that in our world, where all emphasis is put on success and all of that, that song is heard and forgotten by young people. That's the missing of the call. Beware the passing of Jesus, for he may not return.
Does the call only occur when you're young?
Oh, no. But it first occurs when you're young. You know that lovely poem of Wordsworth on recollections of immortality, intimations of immortality. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that comes with us, it's come from God and all this kind of thing. And he tells then of the prison house beginning to close upon the growing boy, but we can still hear the children singing on the seashore, you know? But it may get closed down. On the other hand, if you stay open, you not only hear the song, but you hear it in greater symphonic composition as you go on. And then you know that you're still on the track.
What does contemporary religion have to do with the adventure? Anything?
I think contemporary religion's in a very bad spot. And it's because they have taken the symbols as the reference. And for instance, the symbol, I'm speaking it now, religion is a constellation of metaphors. And a metaphor points to connotations that are of the spirit, not of history. And in our religions, we're accenting the historical image that carries the message, but we stay with the image.
So the literal interpretation of words.
Yeah, and you lose these messages. The thing about Jesus is not that he died and was resurrected, but that his death and resurrection must tell us something about our own spirit.
Why do you think that we do tend to this literal interpretation of the words? Why does that occur?
I think it's the result of a strong institutional emphasis in our religions in the West, and a fear of the mystical experience. In fact, the experience of the divine within you is regarded as blasphemy, you see. I remember having given a lecture once on this problem of becoming transparent to transcendence, so that your life becomes, as it were, a transparency through which some kind of light shines. And I spoke of it as the God in you coming out through your life. And a couple of months later, I met a young woman at another talk of some kind, and she said, "Oh, I was at that lecture you gave on this subject, and I was sitting beside a priest, and when you said the Christ in you asks you to live in that sense, he said, that's heresy. That's blasphemy." Blasphemy was the word that he used. Okay. So all the spirit is out there somewhere, not in you.
Right.
What's the meaning of the saying, the kingdom of heaven is within you, if you can't say it's within me? Then who's in heaven?
And I and the Father are one.
Well, all of that.
Sure.
Well, Jesus was crucified because he said, I and the Father are one.
I'm speaking with Joseph Campbell, a mythologist and author of The Mythic Image, The Masks of God, and many other wonderful works on mythology. We're going to continue our conversation in 1 minute. Joseph, you mentioned Christ was crucified because he said, I and the Father were one. Could you elucidate on that?
Well, the ultimate mystical experience is of one's identity with the divine power. That's the sense of the Chandogya Upanishad saying, Tattvamasi, you are it. That divinity which you seek outside and which you first become aware of because you recognize it outside is actually your own inmost being. Now, it's not a nice thing to say, but it's not good for institutions if people find that, good for religious institutions if people find that it's all within themselves. So there may be some point there about our particular situation in the West, where religious institutions have been able to dominate a society. And it's interesting how they handled this in India. The first half of one's life is spent in the society, obeying the rules, following the rules of one's caste, and worshiping the local images of the divine power. But then there comes a time when you should go into the forest. You give up your caste and everything else, and so the life is divided in half. First, the life in the society, and then the life in the forest. The problem, I think, for Western man is to have the two together, so that you're living the life in the society all through your life. No quitting in midlife and going off and having the high realization, but through the actual living of your life, to realize the play of the divine mystery, not only in yourselves, but through your friends and your enemies. And I think that that's the only possible meaning of Jesus saying, you know, love your enemies. He didn't say don't have enemies, but to have the compassion of recognizing the divine power in them as well as in you. And in the field of time, there's always pairs of opposites. It's got to be that way. Can't be otherwise. And to realize that's the way the one plays through the many is the trick. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As one moves through this process and sees the paradoxes and the dichotomies, and particularly with contemporary religious institutions, and then when one lives in American society, one hears the separation of church and state. At the same time, we now have a situation where we're talking about morality and religion and politics are being wrapped up into one thing. What about that? What's going on?
It's too tight a bundle. Ethics and religion are not the same. Religion has a mystical dimension, and that's what it's really all about. Ethics has to do with social values, and religion has to do with personal inward realization. Those are different things. And living in a society to find your realization of the inward values through the ethics of the society, that's the trick, I might say, of being alive in the world.
But when we look at our contemporary life and look at our institutions in contemporary life, it's very rare that we hear things like, or deal with principles like integrity, ethics, life of the spirit. I mean, if we looked at every bill that comes up before Congress and gets passed and looked at it in terms of its ethical nature or its ethical consequences, I mean, what a different light that would cast on the passage of laws in our government. I mean, the thing is, it seems to be mostly missing from our institutions wherever you look.
Well, you know, one of the problems, I think, in modern life is the rapidity with which social values change. And they change inevitably because the life conditions change. And so there's a lag, and one doesn't know how to evaluate certain things in terms of the contemporary conditions. But politics has to deal with the contemporary moment, and so there you are. You're up against a blank wall. It's almost like a creative world that we were talking about. It's the adventure. As I said somewhere, sometime, we are in a free fall into future. You know, the society itself is on the adventure. Mm-hmm. And so it's awfully hard to evaluate situations. Now, what has happened in this country in the past 30 or 40 years with immigrations of people from totally unforeseen places, you know, with totally different life values from those of the people who, let's say, instituted this country. The people who instituted this country can no longer hold on with confidence to their system, which worked, let's say, do you see? But it's got to open now to other things. I'm living in Hawaii. I think the majority of the people in Hawaii are not Christians. There are a lot of Japanese, a lot of Chinese, the Filipino frequently are Catholic also. But the saying, "In God we trust," it doesn't mean a damn thing to a Buddhist. I had a very amusing experience shortly after arriving in Honolulu. I was invited to give a talk in a church. Now, it was the church to which my wife's family was associated. And when I married Jean and went there, we went to that church. Well, I was brought up a Roman Catholic, and this was actually the first Protestant church service I'd ever experienced. It just seemed to me a kind of meeting, you know. There was no Blessed Sacrament, there was no God in the house, and so forth. Well, I was invited to give a talk to the very people of that church, you see, only a couple of years ago. And I had heard that they had been having some lectures on Buddhism. And they learned that the Buddhists don't believe in God. And so they wondered how they could have a spiritual life not believing in God. So I took that as my clue. And I started by saying that I had heard they just had that series of lectures. But when I first came to Hawaii, and my first experience of a Protestant service was that they didn't have God in the tabernacle. So the Protestants don't have God in the tabernacle, and the Buddhists don't have God in their vocabulary, so how could they have a religious, life? The God image is a metaphor for a spiritual experience, and you don't have to get it through that particular metaphor. This was something that I thought it was an amusing teaser. Well,
So in some sense, we create our own gods.
Yes, that's exactly what we do. No matter what name we give it, the God that we have is the one we're capable of having. That's something people don't realize, that because they're all saying the same name for God, they don't have the same relationship to that or concept of what it is. And the concept of God is only a foreground of the experience. You know, well, there you are. There was this wonderful mystic, Meister Eckhart, you know, contemporary of Dante.
Who a number of Zen Roshis, by the way, have called very Buddhist.
Yes. In this sense, I found, as I was reading a sentence in one of his sermons, and the name of the sermon is On Riddance, Getting Rid Of. And he said, the ultimate riddance, and the most difficult, is the getting rid of your God to go to God. Wow. That's the big adventure, isn't it? That's the ultimate adventure. But that's just saying in big what you have to say every minute of your life to get rid of the life that you have planned in order to have the life that's waiting to be yours, you know, move into the transcendent. That's the whole sense of the adventure, I think.
Joseph, talking about creating our gods, what about our devils, our demons? The same process. In some sense, our gods become our demons, don't they?
My definition of a devil is a god who has not been recognized. Mm-hmm. That's to say, it's a power in you to which you have not given expression. And you push it back. And then, like all repressed energy, it builds up and becomes completely dangerous to the position that you're trying to hold. And so it's a threat. One of the best examples of that and the ambiguity of that is the trickster figure in American Indian, you know, Coyote and the rabbit, great yes. hair and all. He's at once a fool and a creator. And he's a fool in that he is not acting in terms of the order of life that is in being. And he's a creator in that he's a breakthrough, you know. And that's the unrecognized yet pressing energies that are threatening to break through. One of the obsessions, I think, in Christianity is the devil. When I turned from reading Oriental and tribal mythologies to any Orthodox Christian work, suddenly the devil is there. I think he's more important than God. He's the reason for all the wars against other people, you know. He justifies the massacre of primitive tribes. They're all devil worshippers. And anyone who has an experience of the divine that's not that of this particular clergy is worshiping a devil. And that's the word that's actually used for their gods throughout.
I like that story that the Tibetans talk about of when Padmasambhava came to Tibet and he was faced with all of these demons and evil deities of the bone tradition. Mm. He basically transformed them into protectors of the Dharma.
That's it.
And that's what we're really talking
about.
That's
an old mythological trick. The savior hero overcomes a demon and then makes him the protector. There's that wonderful story of the Buddha two incarnations before his last when he was Prince Five Weapons. And he had, as a young man, learned how to use five weapons. And he's riding home now, a triumphant young warrior prince. And out of a forest comes a great big demon, a great monster whose name is Sticky Hair. And the Buddha, the future Buddha, is threatened by this. And he throws at him his javelin, and the javelin sticks in his hair. Then he gets his bow and arrow, and he sends arrow after arrow, and they all stick in his hair. Then he throws his discus, it sticks in his hair. He takes his sword, it sticks in his hair. He takes his club, it sticks in his hair. Then he hits him with his right fist, then his left, then kicks him with his right foot, then his left, and then butts him with his head. Do you recognize this? this is Br'er Rabbit with the tar baby. It's the same story. And so he's stuck. The demon says, I'll bet you're frightened now, boy. And he says, no, I'm not. Because I have that within me, a knowledge that will blow both of us to smithereens. And you're afraid of that. I'm not. So the demon said, okay, let's him loose. So the Buddha had conquered Sticky Hair. And then what did he do? He made him the guardian of that wood. It's the recognition, the dealing with it, and then giving it its place. Its place may be the same place it had, only you've recognized that place and its importance. Do you see what I mean?
And the relevance to that of in everyday practical life is that so often we tend to repress our demons and shove them into the closet, push them under the rug, and not deal with them.
Then that's what they become. They become the monster.
And so then the creative adventure, what could be the creative adventure, becomes the journey through hell.
That's right. There's a very funny situation that has grown up now around this beauty contest queen who was found to have posed for Playboy or something like that.
It's the Miss America.
And it's the whole question of the body, which is taboo in our culture. And so the body, which is the life of our lives, becomes evil, a demon. And even the exposure of it becomes something that isn't tolerated. It's a funny, funny thing.
And then the paradox is, of course, the bathing suit judging and the very contest itself is like kind of looking, going for the body. And at the same time, the paradox of condemning the...
Yeah, both, do you see?
Yes, both are present.
And you feel you're doing something outside the ropes, you know. This is going pretty far, well, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you think it is that we continue to repress our demons and not allow them to, not deal with them?
Well, because they ask for a larger dimension in our lives than we're willing or able to give. I mean... It's important to hold a form and not just to blow. But in doing that, one should know what the powers are that are being asked to hold back, you know, and because recognizing them is part of integrating them. And then the form that you're holding is held in relation to what it's not doing.
Say that again, just for emphasis.
That's always hard. You talk out of an inspiration and then say, what was that?
Yeah, sure, right. Say the same thing differently. How's that?
Yeah. Well, I think one has to control one's life. You know, you can't let all of your impulse system take over. You wouldn't have a life. You'd go to pieces.
But in some sense, when you follow the adventure, you really have to let go of wanting to control it, don't you?
I know, but that's the problem. That's why I say heavy winds blow. There's that saying in the Chandogya Upanishad, or maybe it's the one of the other Upanishads, the narrow blade of a razor is this. It's a narrow, difficult path. And the problem is, this is the real problem of the left-hand path of following your bliss instead of instructions. You're following the lead of your emotion and your vitality, but the head has to be there all the time. And you're on a narrow ridge. And the danger is falling off. That is to say, letting too much of the torrent of energy come through and blow it. There's nothing right or wrong when you're on the path. But there is imprudent and prudent action. Do you see what I mean? Because you're beyond good and evil as soon as you step out of the society. But, you know, you can lose your life that way. That's why it's a dangerous path. It is.
It's also the dangers inherent in becoming what's known as a spiritual teacher. That narrow path is walking.
One of the dangers of the spiritual teacher job is pride. You think you are a spiritual teacher, you know? You're not. You're giving people clues so that they can develop their own spiritual life. But if you take pride... then you've fallen off the sword bridge.
This whole idea of following the life of spirit and having to surrender and give up, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what that surrender is all about. It's really in mythological terms, a surrender to the God within, isn't it?
Yes, but, you know, the God within may not have very much respect for the life that you've got to lead. And so you got to keep God from pushing too hard. Do you see what I mean? Let him come slowly. Because being God is not being on earth. God himself had to descend and get crucified to be on earth, you see. And that business of not getting quite crucified is the task. It is a narrow path. If you're really following the adventure of the impulse system of your life. One of the big impulse moments that many, many people follow is falling in love and marrying a person. I mean, you're not following the rules of the society who select the person you should marry, you know, and all that kind of thing. It's a real adventure. And it's one that you mustn't be afraid of when you begin to find out what a mysterious adventure it's turning out to be. I think the big divorce rate comes from failure to be able to continue the adventure. Because no matter whom you tie up your life to, you're going to find this is a mysterious person, and there's a lot there that I didn't know about, and even the person itself didn't know about, and the person is having the same problem in relation to you as subject.
And both are changing all the time.
All the time.
Having to be open to that change. So often we want to freeze the other person into a position, a place.
Well, naturally, you know, people have a notion of what a marriage ought to be or the marriage they want. You can't have it and have the adventure of a love marriage. I mean, yeah. One or the other.
That's true.
And wherever the love takes you, there you go.
And that's the adventure.
That is the adventure. It's and I see marriage in two stages. One is that wonderful impulse stage of youth, and everything's coming up roses, and the birds are singing, and all that. Then there comes a time when those vital energies aren't there. But at the same time, there is an awakening of spiritual relationship. And when that doesn't happen, you see people getting divorced. I've been shocked at a number of my friends who, they brought up the family, everything was wonderful, the kids are gone, they get divorced. The second marriage, in every marriage, is the mystical one. The first is the physical, then the mystical. And that's the big step of the adventure. The first, we're going to have kids, the kids are going to go to school and all that kind of thing. But that, when you know that story about the priest, the minister, and the rabbi asking, when does life begin? And the priest says, it begins at conception. And the minister says, it begins after 20 days or something like that. And the rabbi says, it begins when the children have graduated and the dog has died. And that's just the time in marriage, you see, when people tend to go apart. They all the things that bound them together, the physical things, the joy of bringing up the family and all that, gone. So what next?
In some sense, too, all of those things have become, in a sense, walls to prevent us from really asking the question,
isn't
why
it?
Am I here?
Yeah.
What is it all about?
You got a lot of reasons, you know, and just to have two cars or to, you know, win a lottery or something like that. But, heaven's sakes, that's the adventure. And it gets to be more and more adventurous the longer you live, I tell you that much.
Well, Joseph, I believe it coming from you. It has to be true.
Yeah, you'll get there, Michael.
Joseph, thanks for joining us today. It's been a pleasure, as always,
to speak
with you once again.
Yeah. I love it, Michael, with you.
I've been speaking with Joseph Campbell, mythologist, author of the 4-volume Masks of God, The Mythic Image, Myths to Live By, and The Way of the Animal Powers, the volume one of the projected 4-volume Historical Atlas of World Mythology. And if you haven't seen that book, I heartily recommend it. It's just a beautiful work, and one that really captures the beauty of the work of Joseph Campbell. My name is Michael Toms. I'm wishing you more adventure in your life. Follow the way of the hero.